I'm Ron Vignac. I'm on staff for a couple of weeks in place of someone who couldn't make it. And for this particular topic, Dave Knutson, who teaches at PLU, I think would be a real resource for us. He understands something of different violence, violence done to the body. I don't know if some of you may know him. He's almost blind now. He has diabetes. A heart condition, he has a leg amputee, he has had all kinds of other complications, and yet through all of that violent activity done to his body, he's able to sing and bring tears to your eyes through his voice. He's able to evoke hope in his theology as he teaches. And he did something very unusual just 2 years ago with his one of his young daughters. He had a tandem bike and rode in a bike race. And I think of Dave often at PLU because not simply because he has this handicap, but because he lives through that violence of the body and yet is able to give such an incredible amount of hope to those who know him and are in his presence. So, with that little background, I think of him here with us. He's sat here before. Ricky, you were mentioning him and his family, his beautiful wife Marilyn, who also has supported him all these years through these many changes that he had to personally live through. But I'd like to open with a sort of a offhand quote from, I don't know who said it even, but it was two Frenchmen speaking to each other. And the one Frenchman said to the other, don't you believe in the brotherhood of man? That was before inclusive language. And the one Frenchman said to the other, yes, I believe in the brotherhood of man. Cain and Abel, Cain and Abel, Cain and Abel. And that was his answer. And as Norm was jokingly saying by title, War on Violence, it brought me to a book which we have both in our library and bookstore. Paul Tournier, I believe he's Swiss, psychologist and Christian. And I'll just write his opening paragraph to his book, The Violence Within. And it's titled, Chapter 1, Ambiguity. We are all against violence, but we are all, to some degree, in favor of it. We all condemn it, and we all have a certain respect for it. Against violence, naturally, there will be little chance of you discussing the point with the members of a guerrilla raiding party. Any guerrillas here? With their hostages held at gunpoint and claiming justification for their violence, the people you meet are more likely to be honest, peaceful folk, Dave, who nevertheless get worked up at the thought of violence, who are properly indignant and condemn violence in severe, sometimes even violent, terms. They want to put it down ruthlessly, violently. You can read the rest of the book if you want to get at where Paul will lead us. And he leaves nothing to chance. He takes the scriptures and just blasts you with it, in a sense, violently, disrupting those of us who claim the God who does not show, in some form or another, violence. So tonight, I think as the forum is, I think everyone in this room certainly could evoke and I think add story upon story of violence, and maybe the violence that you've done to another, or has been done to you individually, or maybe even corporately. There must be an individual here who's 82. Didn't we say happy birthday to someone? Mm-hmm. Who was the man? Do you remember? 82 years old, right? Look what he's lived through since 1903. No, we can't even count the number of revolutions. He's gone through World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, and the whole Vietnam thing, which lasted how many years? 15 for us, at least. 12, 15 years, given the beginning and the end, in which we still pay the price. And so here's an individual in our community who is a survivor of all of that incredible corporate worldly violence.
Here's another one.
Well, yeah, we met before, didn't we? Maybe it wasn't.
I survived the first communist revolution in St. Petersburg, now Leningrad.
And you were there.
Right.
So?
Survived the Russian occupation of 1941, 3 years of Hitler's occupation, 1941 to 1943, and then fled to Germany. And after the Russians reached the point where we were in Germany, I fled again to the central part of Germany, to Thuringia, where we met the American armed forces and thought, now our we'll have to flee from violence anymore. But you know what happened in Yalta, and Thuringia, just like East Berlin, were given to the Russians, so we had to move again to Nuremberg, and finally then to the United States. Violence. I certainly have experienced, when you look back, it's surprising how much violence can be experienced in one lifetime.
And so in our midst is a witness to that. And so maybe tonight we can, Ricky, you had some question that you brought up before as I was talking with you.
Well, I was just thinking in terms of violence, not like corporate violence, but more domestic violence. How do we get along with one another? How do we solve our problems with one another? Until we can solve that on a personal level, it's going to be extremely difficult to try to do it on a national level, unless we can find, you know, new ways to live together in society locally. We are not going to be able to solve the problem otherwise. I think, you know, there are just so many ways in which our society condones, in many ways encourages violence, and I personally think that our parent figure of the television, where you have to get everything solved in a half an hour, and you can't talk it out in a half an hour, so at the end of 25 minutes after a little negotiation, you slap bang, bam bam, and you have a brawl, and then the hero comes out having solved the problem. And I think that really gives a model of that's how you solve the problem. You start, you go through the motions of trying to hear what the other person has to say and trying to share some ideas and coming to some consensus. When that doesn't work, bang, and then you've got some problems solved. I think that's one of the ways that our society promotes violence here in our country.
Please feel free to respond to that, the domestic scene. In my family, we grew up in a very violent problem-solving method. My grandparents were from Russia, and my grandfather drank much, along with all the other men in the family. And he used to come home drunk because he worked on the piers. He was a longshoreman. And my grandmother was not a very tolerant woman, and still not a very tolerant woman. And she would first curse him out in Russian, but if it was really bad, when he couldn't hardly move. I remember one day we were sitting there, because we lived with the grandparents as kids. And he came home, his usual drunk self, but this time he was even worse. And she came after him with a hammer, and she chased him from one end of the house to the other. And all in Russian, "I will kill you, SOB," plus other derivatives of that language.
Can be so cussing that Russian.
Yeah. So I think. She didn't watch much TV. She probably should have watched Bottomless Bass or something. But she used to love to watch, incredibly, in TV in the old days, which today continually is popular. She, I could never understand this from a woman. She used to watch professional wrestling. Yeah, she did. She loved it. And she would cheer. And I'm sitting there as a I still to this day can't.
Gorgeous George jumped up with both feet down on the other one.
She loved it. And well, that was just one example of how to solve domestic problems.
Yeah, but that's another example of, you know, of the, because I really like college or Olympic wrestling. I really enjoy watching that. But I have problems with professional wrestling. It's a show. But it is a show that is a very violent anti the other person show. And the idea is to maim, slaughter, whatever the other person's name. I have a problem with that.
Dick.
When you brought that up, and just reflecting back, I've seen it a couple times on cable nowadays, and I always think it's so funny, you know, all this acting that they go, you know, the show of it all. But I think back to when I was about 7 or 8 years old, we were living up in Canada, and we used to get it all the time, every week, and it would come on Sunday afternoon. And so our Sunday ritual would be we'd go to church, and then we'd come home and have a big dinner, and then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they'd have this Sunday afternoon wrestling, and we'd all watch it. And then we go downstairs and pummel my father for we had a big mattress that would sit out on the floor. And, you know, so we'd sit here and watch TV, and my little brother and I, he was about 2 or 3 years old, and we'd learn all these moves, you know, and then we'd go downstairs and my little 2-year-old brother would try drop kicking my father, you know, or get a knee drop, it was, you know. And I think back about that, how conditioned we were getting to just think that was just great, you know. I don't know if it had any lasting effects or not. I don't do it anymore.
Thank you, goodness.
But it was kind of, so then we go upstairs and watch him sing and have dinner. It was like kind of a bizarre way to spend a Sunday afternoon.
Any others would like to share their experiences of maybe not seriously what abuse or things that have...
Let me jump in here.
Yeah.
When someone pushes against you, what do you do?
Step back.
Push back?
Push back or fall down.
Okay. Very often our automatic reaction is essentially to push back. And that's our fight response. And that's so common to us in our society. It's our way of dealing with being pushed. So I guess for me, as I think about the issue of violence, it's one, becoming aware of how we assume violence as a way of dealing with life. Violence to violate someone, to respond with a fight response, a push-push kind of response, or a win-lose response. And the dilemma that we're faced with is what would be an alternative? What would make sense to us as an alternative way of dealing with things? And because the push-push is so much a part of us. And just a couple other evidences of that in our society. The 5 things that most prematurely end life in our society. The first one is accidents. Second is heart disease, or second is cancer now. Third is heart disease. And the fourth is homicides, and the fifth is suicides.
What is the alternative to the push-push? I can see what I would do perhaps if somebody pushes me. But if somebody pushes somebody else who is close and dear and near to me, what do I do? What's my response?
That makes a good question. What do you think?
John Howard Gilder would suggest you would not raise a hand. Yeah, he recently wrote a book on that very question. and it's here in the library if anyone's interested in picking it up. And it deals with the non-violent response to the question, what if my friend or my grandmother was being attacked by someone with deadly force, what force do I use to deter that attack? And not only Yoder, but a few other people have written that to respond with violence is not a proper response.
And John Howard Yoder is a Mennonite pacifist who's done incredibly helpful work in that whole area of nonviolence. That would be one response. I'll just mention that because that's exactly the situation that comes out of Dial 911 by Dave Jackson, which is also in the library. Similar, he just opens, what would you do if someone broke into your home, began to carry your possessions, or was hurting someone you love? Said, reach for a gun, turn the other cheek, or dial 911 to call the police. Maybe there's more alternatives.
But I bet there's nobody that would do nothing. I think everybody would. If it was to you, if you were being hurt, maybe you would not respond. But say if it was your child, or you would. I think everybody would respond if somebody would attack your child. Don't you think so? Wouldn't just stand there and do nothing.
No, I think there would be a response. I think we're asking, though, what response would be...
I wouldn't think of the ethics of it. If I got a good chance to wallop them on the head with something, I sure would do it. If
yeah,
I could, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would be very protective of myself and of my loved ones.
At what point do you honor your loved ones? Where was one of the stories in Yoder's book deals with that? A grandparent, and the grandparent has made known to you that their response is not to respond in violence, that they would take whatever would happen to them, and you want to overpower their wish by saying, hey, Granny, I'm not going to let the guy hit you, and you're not respecting their decision.
You're not going to have any discussions on that. That's this thing, if you come upon this thing right now, you're either not going to do anything, or, you know, I mean, you got to do something.
Has that happened to people?
Thought come in?
Where you had to respond. I think the hypothetical, if you've ever been in a group where a pacifist is speaking, the question always does come up. Well, what if somebody comes and has a gun pointed to your wife's head? What would you do?
I wouldn't do anything then.
And in a sense, that's a real pacifist, I think, would say, we don't know what we would do.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks they know is really fooling themselves. And I think that is, if we look enough through the annals of crime and homicide and arrest, we probably would find that to be something of a pattern. Yes.
It's also interesting that whenever we talk about violence, it becomes very individualized. We always bring up the question, what if so-and-so would hit you? Very seldom do we ever talk about the collective violence that we find. I think there's much more collective violence and subtle violence that exists. I was talking to a couple of people tonight after they watched the movie on South Africa. And you know, they seem to be much more disturbed about that, at that point at least, and that kind of violence, which expresses itself over long periods of time. It isn't the immediate hit over the head or the shot that we experience on TV. You know, we don't ever see the other kind of violence on TV too often, except maybe on the soaps. They drag that out for weeks and weeks, but that too is a different kind, I guess. But we seem to never get around to talking about that kind of collective violence. Whether that is something that's more difficult to talk about, I don't know. But we seem to find it very easy to talk about what would happen if a robber came into my home, or if my son were to being beaten up, what would I do, kind of thing. I don't have an answer to it, I guess, other than perhaps the other is too hard for our minds to deal with. And then there's the unspoken violence, or the, just the threat. Is the threat of violence as bad as the violence itself? Which brings us into the question then of nuclear weapons, I think. That immediate threat.
The threat is deterrence. Whether we're families or nations, I suppose we, there's something to that. But anyone want to respond to that?
You know, to react in a nonviolent manner in regards to like the nuclear arms or protesting the white train and things like that. For myself, I would have to be trained almost to be nonviolent in that situation, because the emotions are so high when it comes to something, because you do take it personally. It is something that affects you personally and well. And I'm just thinking it really needs training, or people need training in order to react nonviolently.
That's what happens, or is being done with many of the groups that, mm-hmm. that engage in these kinds of things. They receive very intensive training, group support, and discussion, and long hours of thinking things out, thinking them through. So I think you're right that when the moment comes, there is an immediate reaction that you.
I mean, the emotions are so high right at that point. It's like you have to be trained in advance, or, you know, I could easily become violent.
In terms of training for nonviolence, I'd like to turn it back to Dale again. He was talking about fight or flight, very, very kind of immediate reactions that we have. How much training do we have for violence? How much of our violence is something that's trained into us? We were talking about television, and I know as a male, I'm supposed to protect my female, and that's been conveyed to me in my society. But I wonder how much of our violence is trained into us. So if we have to train for nonviolence, I wonder how much of the violence is also trained into us.
Well, I think a lot, a great deal. And I think an interesting thing happened here. We began to raise questions in terms of our violence. We went to a situation where we felt maybe we could justify our violence. And my hunch is that very, very little violence is perpetuated that people don't feel justified about. That everyone who's doing violence to others feels somehow that they are justified in it. And what I hunch that's about is that if we really don't see the alternative, that we are locked into a feeling that life is a win-lose operation. Either you're a winner or you're a loser, and you better be a winner. And when we approach situations with that assumption, then we often can't see the alternatives. Now, underlying that then is, how do you win? Again, with the way we tend to see things, we win with power. What's the most powerful force in life? What came to your mind? What are some things that came to your mind? What's the most powerful force in life?
Gandhi came to my mind.
Okay.
IBM came to
mind.
Home is love.
Okay.
Self-preservation.
Okay. And we tend to think of physical force, usually, as the most powerful force. And then using systems, your concern around using systems to get our way. Economic systems, political systems, that kind of force. So someone is attacking someone, your loved one. What would it mean to turn on love at that point? Say, the most powerful force right now is love.
You see, it isn't practical in a situation like that, because you don't have the time. I mean, how would you turn on love to a stranger that was just about to kill your child?
How would you?
If you said, you know, I love you, please don't do that, they probably wouldn't stop.
I'd like to offer another dimension to that particular situation that you're raising. If you're in a situation where somebody breaks into your house and you have to decide how you're going to react, you may react automatically and not be able to carefully consider. But there is another time when you can do something. What happens to the person who is arrested by the police and taken to jail? We can work with that person. We can intervene in the past violent history for that individual. We can show love and concern at a time when they're off the drugs or off the alcohol that most likely is part of the problem at the time they broke into your house. And we can then get involved in an alternative action that may prevent that person from doing that again and that person's children and family from causing further problems. So the time of reaction can be immediate or it can be from then on throughout the rest of their life or your life. So when you talk about alternatives, I think you need to expand your understanding of what it means and how to intervene in the violent action.
Another shift to the focus might be from looking at the other to looking at mononuclear families and what abuse is, what physical abuse takes place between spouses and children and the power struggle there when someone wants to, or one is feeling a loss of control or power and strikes out as being physically stronger. Has that ever happened in one situation?
This is on tape, isn't it?
I don't think so.
I I'm not good for nothing anyway. I think that for me, when our son Philip was very young, I saw the worst of the violence within me, because this was something that was just not only uncontrollable, but absolutely driving me crazy. I mean, imagine living with a smoke detector that was faulty and would go off at all unpredictable times, and no matter what you did to try to repair it, you could not repair it. And it would always wake you at night and you were never rested enough. And furthermore, it was a human being and you couldn't just throw it away or take it back to the hardware store or something. There were times when I picked up that baby and just said, why don't you tell me what's wrong? And I mean, that sounds kind of funny, but that is really a dangerous thing. And that I've read since then that this can be damaging to the child's brain. And I think Philip is not suffering lately.
You can always blame it on that.
I think, but I am better than I used to be. And I think that for me, that transformation came about.
I think what we've, the question of how do we, if we need to train for nonviolence, in other words, how do we unlearn then that which is often told that we should be aggressive. I mean, we all are aggressive in some way, and we encourage aggressiveness. Even in our virtuous things that we go after, we want fervor, we want enthusiasm for the good. It may be violent in the end, but we still want that forcefulness. And so what are some of the, as we think through as a community, how do we deal with violence up here? A lot of us don't think there's a violent bone in any of the people up here. They're such nice people. Just go through here some night.
Try volleyball at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, volleyball.
Take it out of the bill.
But is all violence then, I think we need to be careful we don't reduce it to simply all violence comes out of frustration either, which is quite normal. But
you don't have a position that you ought to have.
Wanting to be in control.
Yeah, and maybe that's one way we, you know, and that's one way I've found to deal with violence is by letting somebody feel like they are, they do have some status. Most recent example I have of that, I was working temporary job at a department store last Christmas time, and we had a new employee came in, and he was being very aggressive. He knew there was only going to be one job at the end of the Christmas season, and wanted to be the person who had it, and realized that I was the only one that had the seniority ahead of him. I didn't realize that I didn't want the job anyway. But, you know, the first day we were working there, it was, I sensed an immediate tension, and, you know, he was doing his utmost to, and it actually got to the point, and the first time it had ever happened in years, where he said, come on, take a swing at me. I mean, you know, verbally abusing and all that. He said, come on, fight me. You know, come on, take a swing, I dare you. And I kind of looked at him, and I just, you know, because that wasn't the way things were supposed to happen, and yet I was pretty mad at him at the time. I mean, you know, I don't like being called names and things. But I looked at it back at it later and realized that once I had told him, you know, he apologized later, really, but hadn't really changed, and I finally said, you know, I don't want this job. I'm not your competition. I'm here for another month and I'm gone. I never had another problem with them afterwards. I mean, that's a selective case, but I think it can be generalized a lot. People feel threatened or lack of security. Somebody's...
In families, I think the control issue, even with a small child, when they're, you know, what can I do to make this stop? I can't, I've lost control. That's often, I think, when we feel most violent. Or when a child's behavior is so irrational, it's out of control. Maybe it is rational, we just understand why they're doing that, but when we feel like we've lost control, that we tend to go at that.
I'd like to then go back to, is it Anna Marie?
Yes.
Yeah, you had a very interesting ending to your the dilemma that was presented, because you said, well, it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Something of that sort. And then, but at the end you said, but I don't think it would work, would it? And again, it's that point of vulnerability. How do you remember Archie Bunker? Do you remember the episode where Archie and Edith come in the house and they're being robbed? Does anybody remember that episode?
Oh, yeah.
It's a classic episode. Yeah. And here are these two black guys, cool, and they're running around filling bags full of stuff. And then Edith and Archie come in. Of course, what do you can expect what Archie's response was. What was Archie's response?
Went for a gun.
Went for a gun. And who gets hold of the gun? Yes, the robber takes the gun from Archie. And of course, Archie then is all of a sudden humbled pie. Does anybody remember Edith's response?
She probably offered them some coffee.
She offered them coffee. She offers them. And this guy is just so overwhelmed by the incredible nuttiness of it. After they sit down and they actually eat, they have something. And then at the end, he looks at Edith and he says, "This, you know, you're almost too good to believe." He gives her all the stuff back. And then they accept the gun. They don't give Archie the gun back. And then they go out and say something like, "See you later." And then they leave. And
you're in the neighborhood.
I think there's a, you know, you were teasing in a. I think your last question. Well, but maybe it would work. The alternative, whatever that is.
Yeah.
I'm just. Yes.
I worked in the national park and we went through some training what to do with people who are getting violent, like to become law enforcement stuff. And I'm a volunteer, and one of the things they said to do is just catch them completely off guard and say, "I don't know what I'm doing here, I'm just a volunteer."
I'm not a threat to you.
Yeah.
What you're saying, I'm not a threat to you. Violence, when we respond with violence, justifies unlimited violence by our opponent. I remember in Chicago two incidents. One, there were we we were in a kind of rough part of town, and a couple of University of Chicago students were walking down the sidewalk, and a guy stepped out with a gun, hold him up. And one of the students decided he was going to take control of the situation, went into a karate stance, mm-hmm. and was shot and killed. The other person was left alone. He probably never would have been shot if he hadn't justified the other person's violence back for him. The other was a couple that were very good friends of ours. He was a Roman Catholic priest who had left the orders, and his wife was a nun, ex-nun. They came home one night and ran into a guy who was with a knife. And they deliberately chose not to deal with him violently. In the process, Julie was raped, and John was burned with cigarettes and some other things at the time. It's very. They continued to follow through the process after the guy was arrested, and they met with him in the prison and went through a process of forgiveness that I was amazed how healthy they came out of that situation. When other people that I know who have been raped have had long-term disability in terms of emotional crippling. And these folks, I don't know that I could do that, but I was really impressed by that. Their own health and the future of that person came out so different. And
I wonder what enabled them to forgive.
Their faith is the only thing I can connect that to. They're both deeply religious people.
Isn't that remarkable in this forum tonight? This is the first time that we've mentioned that trust that we have, I think.
Yeah, but they got out of it alive. That makes a difference. If they hadn't got out of it alive.
I think they would have said that if they had not, that if they had used violence, well, I'm not suggesting that, I'm not saying that if they'd used violence, they wouldn't have come out of it alive. That may be the case, but that's not my argument. If they had used violence, they would have been participating in death. John would probably have said that, you know, he would have been endangering his own soul. That's the way he would phrase that.
Well, during World War II, there was in Denmark a minister who was speaking very much against the German occupation, and it was he was very much of a pacifist. He would not. His preaching was what is it called? That they should not allow the oppression, but resist without violence. And his way of doing it was to, when one of the crises came up in Denmark, to go to the church on Sunday morning, but he didn't open the doors. He stood outside. It should probably be said too that on Sundays that church was always full for people standing far out. He was preaching outside, and the next day he was taken by the German and shot. So his nonviolence didn't take him anywhere.
I don't know about that. See, I wouldn't draw the same conclusion. Because a person is killed does not mean that they lose.
His family did.
That doesn't mean that necessarily. Well, they lose, yes, but what is it? What does it mean to live? What does it mean to lose?
One of the things that I've been thinking about as people have been talking is that because I'm not sure if it is human nature to push back if you're pushed. I mean, I don't know if we've learned that or if that's the way the organism was developed to respond. I don't know if anybody knows that for sure. But because we think it is, and we think, well, that's just the way we're supposed to respond, it's natural, it's normal, we don't explore other alternatives very seriously. We don't ever sit around and go, now what can I live with and what can't I live with? Your friends that you described, they must have really had a core of thoughts and beliefs that took them in, that took them through that situation. That wasn't their they had to work it out ahead of time somewhat. And I think we don't do that very much. We just think, oh well, violence begets violence. If somebody's violent to me, I would be violent back.
In fact, we go the other direction. We do everything we can to prepare for violence.
Yeah.
Nuclear war is an excellent example of that. We're now to the point where we know how long we're going to take to make our decisions. You know, it's going to be less than 8 minutes in some situations, and we've got that all timed down. We've got the criteria there, and we've got the chain of command. We've got all that figured out. We've almost never done anything to look at alternatives.
People with guns in their nightstands or taking charter practice, I mean, they're doing sort of the same thing on a personal level. And I don't want to be a violent person. I don't. I mean, I would sacrifice a lot, I think. I don't know how much. But there's not much support for people who don't want to be violent. I mean, where do you look for somebody?
Where do you look for training?
And yeah.
You're going to go out and be a demonstrator against the white train. I think there are specific, you know, training programs for people who are going to do that. But where in our schools do we have any training for nonviolence? Mm-hmm. I love competitive sports. I really enjoy that. But a lot of competitive sports is you're going to beat the other guy. It's a win-lose situation. And we have coaches who are well paid, you know, to coach you in how you're going to beat the other guy. A win-lose situation. Really not much coaching done in how you find ways to solve problems, how you find ways to resolve differences in any other way than you win, that means I lose, or if you lose, that means I win.
Yeah. I'll tell you about an experiment that was done. Some of you may have heard me tell, but it was done down in California, and they took a group of 9-year-old boys from California and another group from Mexico, and then they would bring them in pairs into the room. Two boys from the United States, and then next would come two from Mexico. And they had them do an exercise. They had a rope with a knot in the middle of it, and they put one boy in each end of the rope and a line in the middle of the floor, and they said, okay, now we're going to give you a dime every time you can get that knot to pass over the line. And so the United States boys came in, they said, on your marks, get set, go. And they just pulled for all they were worth. And the knot went back and forth, you know, slowly each way. And so they'd say, okay, 5 times over the line, here's 50 cents. And then they brought the Mexican boys in and gave them the same instructions and said, on your marks, get set, go. And they went.
Cooperation versus competition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think both are well taken. I think, you know, in the anthropological studies, been recorded for many years, and Margaret Mead, you know, despite she's been discounted for some of her data, has some real significant things to say about different societies that were even 100 miles apart. You know, she wrote a book called Sex and Temperament, where she looked at one society, and they were cannibalistic, and they were headhunters, and 100 miles down the road, there was another group of people where the men actually and the women were together taking care of the child, and they had soft baskets opposed, you know, they carried their children in. And, you know, I think that's kind of what I hear you saying. And I think, you know, the question's been raised tonight, you know, how are we socialized? What are we doing to our children? And I think we are. Many studies have told us or indicate that we are socialized in a violent way, and that there are other cultures where people aren't socialized in a violent way. And the next step is to, how do we become aware of that, and how do we get a mindset to change that? And in response to, is it Ricky? Yeah, you know, your comment about the school. I've been working in the schools for quite a few years, and I've been a special ed teacher, and I've had to deal with behavior problems and emotionally disturbed kids. And at first, my response was a very violent one. I mean, I wanted to suppress their anger, and I learned that wasn't effective at all. That I would have to come and say, yeah, it looks like you're real angry about that. And I mean, the first time I say that to a child, they kind of look at you. like, it's okay that I'm angry? And you go, yeah, but it's, let me tell you the rules now. It's okay that you're angry. You can't hit anyone else. You can be over here for a while. And I mean, there's days where I have to physically hold children down. I have to put them in a safety hold so I'm safe, other kids are safe, they're safe. But you just keep talking it through. And what's been encouraging for me in that whole process is I've come to have a new mindset of children. And it's amazing. We've had, you know, young children come in, and within a week, they're no longer throwing kicking tantrums. They're able to say, yeah, I'm angry, and I just need to sit on my chair for a while. And I mean, even I still today go, wow, you know. And it's just that little thing, it's that little perception, and I believe it even in the schools, it's communicating with kids and talking with kids and letting them know if their feelings are okay, specifically anger, so it doesn't become a violent response. And I've seen, you know, this past year, a violent four-year-old who came in from an alcoholic family. I mean, the mother was just hysterical, had a terrible background, had an infant that was screaming, you know. I mean, screaming such that we had a social worker walking around with the kids so that the mother could calm down. And the little boy, a year later, who had been throwing his tantrums, reaches over to his mother and he goes, it's okay, Mom. And, you know, you think, wow, if we can have this impact on four-year-olds and five-year-olds, if we just get a different mindset, you know, what can we do, you know, in terms of each other? And it's been interesting for me because I've come to say that to my family. Yeah, it's okay that I'm angry about something. It's okay that you're angry, but we can't act it out on each other. And what are some appropriate things we can do? We can play volleyball. We can, you know, run. I mean, I have gotten in my car, you know, several times in the past 10 years and gone down the freeway going, oh, my mother, until I come to the point of tears and I drive home and I'm okay. But I think that's real important that, you know, we have to learn how to deal with our anger. And I'm encouraged that in this small instance, and I don't know how to generalize it in terms of world issues and nuclear warfare, but I think that, you know, we have been enculturated to violence, and we can see that there are other cultures that aren't socialized that way, and that change can be made, and I think that's real encouraging.
You mentioned something really important, which is that change can begin at that small level. You're teaching new ways to respond. I work in a jail, and the people that I work with have a real background in violence, and they don't know any other ways to respond, whether it's immediate to somebody who takes their commissary items, or whether it's to somebody who threatens them when they're in a criminal situation. And simply talking with them and presenting them with other ideas of responding to something that doesn't allow them to lose faith, or what they think may not be losing faith, is really important. Because what you're saying, it can spread. As those children grow, they're going to share those kinds of responses with other people. And if we could encourage in the school that kind of training, and then perhaps influence some of our media influences to show other ways of responding that are acceptable and allow you to keep your self-respect, that can be, those kinds of ways can spread broadly, rather than taking it at the larger level. I think starting at the smallest level and working our way out is really the most effective.
Well, and I think what might scare people is, you know, like, people come into my classroom and I have kids smashing cans and they go, wow, that's really violent. But it's an appropriate way for those kids to get out their anger. And when I have a lot of, you know, real angry kids, we smash cans once a week. And sometimes individual kids smash cans and I'll try and give them lines. I'll say, and I've had kids, you know, they're smashing, and yeah, and I'm real angry at Janet, and they're smashing, and please, when the kid goes, yeah, and I'm real angry at Janet, and I kind of look up and they smile, but they are, and it's okay for them to know that they can be angry with me too. And then parents, you know, start collecting cans and start smashing, so what you're saying is, you know, but wait, what it all means is that there's appropriate ways to deal with, you know, anger, and that it can be generalized.
I think another thing that you're doing, which is really good and happy, is first of all, recognizing that in everybody, violence is just much a part of us, and love and the positive things. And I think if we can recognize that violence isn't all so bad, I think people are afraid to express and they keep it hidden so long. And, you know, it's got to be learned to dealt with, and the first thing is to recognize that we all have it.
I would dissent with that point, because I think using the royal we here is wrong. Being a male, the idea of violence is not from doesn't come from female interactions. It's very much a masculine approach to deal with insecurities. And we're all talking around, and it's interesting to hear the women saying, you know, we've got all this violence built up in us, but it's kind of conditioned about how males have interacted from scriptural time to even the present day. It's a real masculine trip to deal with physical violence, although it's, you know, it's experienced by females, whether it was there just all inside us, but I'm not sure. I think it's a real male problem. And oftentimes we really try to say, oh, it's all society's problem, but it's really not, because the male's always been the one in the physical position of having more power. And when that is threatened, the quickest way to lash out is using that physical power. And they don't like it. From different courses that I've been involved with in family relationships, the only way a male can dominate often is through physical power. And when they feel a wife coming on and saying, go ahead, do what you want to me physically, you're not going to control me, that brings oftentimes death in those situations, because there's no way out, because I can't beat this person by just, you know, giving her black and blue marks all over the place. I'm going to have to get rid of her. My power is threatened to that extent. So it's a real male problem.
Well, there's violence with words, too.
Yeah. True. And I mean, that often happens.
I'm talking the greatest weapon some people have.
Yeah. Well, it can be.
If we limit violence to physical violence, maybe you're saying that's more a male problem, but I would hope we wouldn't limit it to physical violence, because I think there's a lot of kinds of violence, ways of exerting power over each other that can violate a person. And that, I think, is equally a male-female problem.
Yeah. Well, I would steal the sense, because I think it really originates with males dealing with it. You look throughout history, and where it's always been a male-dominated world, at least our government, not our government, our nation and our roots, most of them, it's been male confrontation. Although it's females get involved in the wordplay as well as males do, it really comes out.
You mean I have to be a man in order to kill somebody?
Pardon me?
I have to be a man in order to kill somebody?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I don't think it makes any sense.
Well,
I think women are equally capable of violence. They may not have quite as much physical power in some cases as some men may have, but it doesn't take a great deal.
Also, women are conditioned to turn their violence inside.
Well, and maybe women have been smart enough to get the men to go out there and get killed.
I think as we move towards the end, I'd like to, one of the interesting things that's happened in the last 5 years, the Center for Disease and Control, which is located in Atlanta, Georgia, is under study to look at violence as a medical problem, not just as a some sort of social problem, but in fact, doctors, psychiatrists, all realms of the medical sciences are looking at the human, because the easy answer is not, I mean, we can't come just with a, we can't explain sometimes that, play, you know, Margaret Mead, where she found these two. And I think that at least is a direction that in fact they're taking seriously the nature of our violence to one another, not just the physical, but the fullness of the human as we confront the other person.
Now, I wanted to add that Hans Selye has done a lot of the research on stress, and he says the attitude that is most detrimental to your own body is revenge. That attitude does more to give you the diseases you have than anything else. And in reaction to, I think, the question you were raising, in terms of alternatives, as long as we only see what we're looking at right here, what seems obvious to us, the power trips somehow seem to be reasonable. And when Jesus says, if someone forces you to go 1 mile, go 2, and he says, why do you fear the people who can only destroy your body? The only way that can make sense is by faith to know that the kingdom of God is at hand. And only when we shift to that kind of perspective do we begin to see the practicality of what Jesus is saying. That you win ultimately when you're willing to go with the burglars, even if it means giving your life. And discovering how to do that. Now, often what happens, and I think the reality of it too, is that you end up not losing your life. Every time there's a loser, you've got an enemy for the rest of your life. If you win, another person loses. If there's a win-win experience, you potentially have a friend.
But you see, I didn't think my life was threatened. I was thinking my child's life was threatened. Okay. And I feel different about it too. I would tend to be more violent if somebody attacks my child than if they attack me, because I'm really basically a non-violent person.
In reaction to what's been said, talk about alternatives and talk about training, and the first thing we always talk about is to react with violence when we see violence. There are alternatives, there are other things to do. Probably the most effective that I have seen in my own experience working in a jail, working as a policeman, is to shock. Say something out of the ordinary, like, I see that you're angry. Recognize and give permission to the anger, and recognize that, or share, I recognize that it's angry, it's okay that you're angry, it's not okay for you to hit me, or hit somebody else.
Speaking of alternatives, what alternative would you give to Jesus when he cleansed the temple? He didn't do it with pillows, but with something more substantial. What alternative would you suggest to him?
I think force can be administered in love.
And I think we'll end with that and shift to one of the other alternatives, and that's to worship in his name and to be calmed by his word and to sing in unison the gifts that are given to us all.